What do you love about college radio?
I love the constant variety of content and people who come through the door and the different people that I get to work with every day.
Well, all I know is if there's no radio stations in heaven, I don't want to go.
On this edition of Radio Survivor, we're going to remember radio original Negative Lands, Don Joyce. And we're joined in studio by Jennifer Waits.
I'm here. Going to talk a little bit about some of my radio station tours.
And we'll also hear from Matthew Lassar in Lassar's Letter on Radio. And my name is Paul Rees-Mandel. I'm one of your hosts.
I'm Eric Klein. I'm a co-host.
I'm Jennifer Waits, and this week I'm a co-host, too.
So glad to have you live in studio rather than over Skype this time, Jennifer. What brings you up here through Portland, Oregon?
We're on our summer family vacation, and we decided to take a road trip up to Portland and Seattle. I live in San Francisco, and I'm going to see how many radio station field trips I can squeeze in, because you know I'm obsessed with visiting radio stations. So I'm here with my husband and my 9-year-old daughter, so it's a bit tricky because they don't always want to do what I want to do, but I managed to bring them to a station yesterday and maybe a couple more on the trip.
So you're going to find out what that threshold is they have.
Yes. Well, my husband did college radio too, so he's kind of interested.
And your daughter is destined.
Yeah, she's been in a radio studio before. I'm a DJ at KFJC, the Foothill College station in the Bay Area, and she's been on the air with me. She's done some kind of technical behind-the-scenes stuff there, so she's comfortable.
And she helped you out a little bit. You brought us some audio from your first tour here.
Yeah, and so actually this is a tip. If there are other people who want to go tour radio stations with their child, give them a microphone and have them record interviews on the tour. So we did that towards the end of the visit, and she kind of didn't want to stop. So we'll actually hear her voice in some of our audio clips.
I'm really excited about that, about having now having these audio tours of college stations, in addition to the excellent write-ups that you've been producing, both for your own website, spinningindy.com, as well as for us at radiosurvivor.com.
Yeah, it takes it to a whole new level. I started touring stations in 2008, so I've been doing it a long time, and I think this was the first time I'd ever recorded audio yesterday on a tour.
Great. So we'll hear that later in the show.
Absolutely. And maybe to start, we'll look at some things going on in radio-related news. And one big story is AT&T, which is the number two wireless carrier in the United States, announced that they will activate the FM radio chips that are inside most Android phones beginning in 2016. And this is something I've been following for quite some time, because I've had a couple of Android phones in the past that had FM radios, and I thought that was great, to build the ability to just have a radio always with me, because I always have my phone with me, and now I don't have to use data to listen to it. And then it's free, and it doesn't suck up all the power. But strangely enough, the US carriers mostly turn these chips off, or tell the manufacturers to have them off when you get them. For reasons that, you know, we'd like to come up with a big conspiracy theory about it, but that are still kind of unknown why they simply don't. Because if you go to Europe, for instance, or even, you know, to South America or to other parts of the world, they leave them on. So there's no problems, listening to the radio on your phones. But here they're turned off. And Sprint, going back to 2013, started turning on the chip in their phones. And they did it in coordination with Emmis Broadcasting, which is one of the larger radio broadcasting companies in the country. They developed this app called Next Radio, which is kind of cool because it turns on and lets you listen to radio, but it also knows what stations are in your area. So it's smart about telling you what stations it can pick up, and is smart about what stations are also online. So it can kind of take you from their online stream to their FM stream and back. I always feel like it was almost like 10 years too late, but at the same time, you know, it's great. And so this AT&T deal that's happening right now, beginning in 2016, is also similarly with Next Radio, so that you'll be able to use this same app on the AT&T phones. But it still begs that question, why can't we just have FM radios in our phones with this app or not? It's a very strange thing, but I mean, it's a good thing for radio, I think, because a lot of people are now starting to use their phones as their principal radio listening devices.
What's interesting to me about this story is that the technology was already inside of the phone, but turned off. So,
yes.
And then it is kind of strange that AT&T, the provider of the service, is the one that decides to turn it off or on, not the consumer, I guess, or the phone manufacturers.
Right. Yeah, and that's a sort of unique to the United States, because here we tend to get our phones directly through from our carriers, subsidized.
Right.
Whereas in a lot of other countries, it's more likely that you buy them outright or buy them separately and then load them up with the chip and everything. So it's a bit more of this kind of, you buy a phone and you might work with any number of different carriers, whereas here you tend to be tied. You have like an AT&T phone, or you have a Verizon phone, or you have a Sprint phone. And that's why the carrier dictates like the software. You know, if you notice, you'll have software or that's sort of dedicated to your carrier. Not so much with iPhones, but with a lot of Android phones, it'll be larded up with a bunch of useless apps dedicated to your carrier.
So, Paul, you'd mentioned that it wasn't available in iPhones. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. So, supposedly, there is no FM radio in an iPhone, so which is one reason why it's not available. There have oft been rumors that there's some hidden FM radio in iPhones that has yet to be activated. It's sort of like a sleeper cell, I think, waiting for the ghost of Jobs to come in and command them to life. Mm. But that has never been confirmed. So the best of our knowledge is that iPhones do not have FM radios in them. Although, I guess one model of iPod, if you remember iPods, I think it's the iPod Nano, has an FM radio built into it.
That's right. Aw.
So cute.
Yeah, quaint.
So we wonder if that will put some pressure on Verizon, which is the number one manufacturer in the U.S., or not manufacturer, number one wireless carrier in the U.S. to start activating the FM radios. If I put my policy hat on, I think it's AT&T sort of, one, throwing a bone to the radio industry, but the radio industry has been trying to marshal forces to get the FCC to make turning on the FM radios mandatory. And certainly, if there's anything the radio industry would – or sorry, the wireless industry would prefer to do, it would be to demonstrate, hey, we are we're just simply going to comply. You know, we don't need to have any regulation making us comply. And Chairman Wheeler has made statements, Chairman Wheeler of the FCC, to the effect of like, we'd rather see the industry work this out on their own rather than have us get involved with that. It seemed like something the FCC wasn't very interested in taking up. So I wouldn't be surprised if, to some extent, AT&T going ahead and turning on these FM chips wasn't a little bit of, I wouldn't say a backroom deal, but a little bit of sort of due diligence to try and tell the FCC, that's right, you can let us work it out. You know, since you threw us this bone, we'll do it. Because the cost to AT&T, next to zero, as far as I can tell. And in the deal with Sprint, MS Broadcasting promises to give them in-kind radio advertising, to advertise Next Radio, essentially. But so, I mean, and also Next Radio, the app, has advertising in it, and they share those proceeds with Sprint. So I wouldn't be surprised if AT&T hasn't struck a similar deal, and is therefore not only is it not going to cost them anything, they may actually make a little bit of money off of it.
This whole thing just makes me sad. Because it's like, for the consumers, for the humans in this story, like having your radio, having the thing that's in your pocket that you paid for also be a radio makes sense. It shouldn't be anyone else's business but our own if we want to listen to it and it already is available technology. And yet it's not up to us. It's up to them.
Yes. So we'll see. That doesn't begin till 2016. And I'm not sure whether it will be turned on your existing phones, but it will be if you get a new phone, right, in 2016.
Ooh, radio in the future.
In the future, you will have a radio in your pocket. And Eric, you had an interesting story you wanted to share, sort of following up on a conversation that we had a number of weeks ago with Ernesto Aguilar, who discussed, you know, Latino audiences and public radio being able to serve Latino audiences and also bringing, you know, really attracting Latino audiences.
Yeah, this is a great story that came across my feed by Neiman Lab that was about a Pasadena, California, which is in Southern California in the Los Angeles area, a radio station, a public station called KPCC that engaged in a ambitious long-term project to increase their Latino listeners, their English-speaking Latino audience. So what interested me about the article, which we'll link to on the website if people want to dive deeper, because it's there's a lot of things going on in this story, but I thought what was interesting was the it was clearly a controversial choice for the station culture as it existed and for, I'm assuming, the audience that was already felt ownership of that station. It didn't go easy. It didn't go down easy, these changes that they made. But in the, one of the morning show hosts that was called upon to share her show with one of these new hosts that was hired to engage this Latino audience, the theoretical Latino audience that they knew was out there, she ended up quitting, not being able to work within this new framework. And that was probably the most clear example of how this change didn't go down easy, but it worked for what it's worth. The numbers bore out that they engaged this audience, and the station succeeded.
Yes, and part of it for public radio, I think, is the very fact that the percentage of Latinos in the general audience is going up. And it's important, and something that Ernesto definitely stressed to me, is that it's to understand that this is an English-speaking audience, not just a Spanish-speaking audience. And so for public radio and community radio, for that matter, to make sure it's engaging with a Latino audience is in their best interest. It's not, certainly we hope that from a public service standpoint, that is something that every station would want to take seriously. But that also, because of shifting demographics, being able to engage a Latino audience means engaging a younger audience and means engaging an audience that will become loyal funders down the line. And so it is really about development and growth, in as much as it is also about something which is good public service.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention this story in passing because, I mean, on the one hand, we're just going to mention it because it's important. On the other hand, there's so many different facets to the story worth drilling down into that I did want it to be on the radar as far as our listeners go. And then I know that, Paul, I had brought this up to you as an idea for a topic on the show, and you pointed out that The Pub, which is Current's podcast, very well-produced podcast about similar stories and issues as this podcast, that they took it on in a very recent episode.
Yes, and Adam Ragusea, the host of The Pub, does a fantastic job. It's a very good podcast, and I think something which Ernesto also recommended, and he said you could sort of listen to our show in The Pub as sort of complimentary programs in your feed to really get this broad view of community and public radio. And so certainly we'll put a link to that in the show notes, but if you want to learn more, I know that Adam talked with the author of that study, which was in the Neiman Lab website there. And then looking at sort of something a little bit more fun and cultural here, KEXP recently did a very interesting special that we wanted to talk about a little bit. Eric, what was that?
So yeah, KEXP, the music station in Seattle, that's a community station, volunteer run.
Yes.
And they got a lot of attention, and I actually found out about this from an article in Digiday, digiday.com, that we'll have linked on the Radio Survivor page for this podcast. They played every song sampled by the Beastie Boys in their 1989 album, Paul's Boutique, which is a nice album, and also famous for being so filled with samples that it couldn't possibly financially work under the current music licensing regime. It would cost too much. It's a kind of artwork that is unique to its time and place because it's such a mainstream success, but also is sample rich. And so KEXP went ahead and over a multi-hour broadcast,
12 hours,
played every single 12. Song.
12 hours, yeah.
Played every single song that was sampled on Paul's Boutique. And it was a huge success as far as the internet is concerned. They really increased By noon Pacific time, Reese is reading from this DigiDay article. By noon Pacific time, nearly 2,000 tweets mentioned the album. On a typical day, that number is less than 50, according to social analytics firm Topsy. And KEXP was mentioned in 808 tweets in that past day. And the station hosted 10,000 live streams, which was double its normal online listenership. Most notably, the Beastie Boys themselves, their Twitter account, mini-blogged a link to KEXP's stream during that broadcast.
That's crazy. I mean, I know at KFJC, where I DJ, our email list was abuzz about this. People were really excited about it, and they were checking out the actual 12-hour presentation, and then I think people are digging into the archives, too, because you can listen in the archives. But yeah, 12 hours, and it also had interviews and some rare demos during those 12 hours. And it was inspired by a similar special they did about, now I can't remember, but it was inspired by a similar special they did about another album, I think. So this might be part of an ongoing series where they dig into something. But I never actually heard of a special like this where they a station dissects one album.
Right. And then the other thing that the DigiDay article really focused on was how KEXP did a whole lot of legwork prior to the day's broadcast to publicize the work. So it wasn't just something that they worked on and then put on the radio. They did a lot of press releasing and social media work prior to the broadcast to get it out there, which clearly paid off.
I think it shows sort of the value of this event sort of broadcasting, which is something I think college radio and community radio does quite a bit of, actually. Sometimes it's done in coordination with pledge drives or with fund drives, but often done for a lot of other reasons. And I think what KEXP is showing is how that can really be used to help develop your listenership and to bring your station to the attention of people who may not have known about it before, both locally in your local community and also nationally and globally. And KEXP has a sort of more national outlook for a community radio station, has that significant online presence. And it was interesting to hear the numbers, because you almost never hear anyone talk about the streaming numbers. And that's because for most stations, their online simultaneous streams are actually quite small. You had mentioned it, actually, think in one story last week, was it, Jennifer, about, you know, having 20 or 30 online streams, and that's a lot. So to hear 10,000, that's a really huge listenership when you really think about it, all of people listening all simultaneously online, because even in a lot of major cities, a regular radio station won't have that many listeners,
right,
all simultaneously to their regular airwaves.
And clearly they're prepared for that, if they can have that many listeners for a big event like that. So it's pretty astonishing to me, too.
But there's a lot of lessons, I think, there to be learned that another station could take, you know, with, even if it's on a 12-hour marathon. But if you're going to do some special programming around something that you might think would be of general interest, to really let people know in advance, because I think that's something which, I mean, I will say that during my time in radio, I'm certain I was very bad at that as well. And I think it's always difficult because it's the last thing you think of doing, because you're getting all the logistics together. You've got all this energy going into doing a good job. And then it's like, oh, now we should let people know about it. And sometimes it's often just hours in advance. You know, sometimes it's even you do a poor job of letting people know on your own airwaves and doing promos and things like this. But then seeing how using social media, using Twitter and Facebook, and I have no idea what else was in their campaign, can also help, because it, you know, it helps then for other people to turn into your street team. Right. And of course, this one, clearly it hit the right zeitgeist, I suppose, and got people very excited about it. But it seems like an example that's worthy of analysis, actually.
Yeah. You know, college radio stations, too, I see them sending out press releases and reaching out to people. And there's some publications that will write about any press release sent to them. So it's actually easier than you think to get press for radio. And I agree that in this case, it's crossing over into all these different interest areas. So Beastie Boys fans are from all walks of life. So they really hit on something.
Yeah. I mean, I just think about that album, right? And I think it took 12 hours of songs. I mean, it wasn't quite 12 hours of song, but took 12 hours to do that deep dive into that album and all those samples, how richly and densely layered that is.
Yeah, and interviews, you know, they were talking to the producers. But it's interesting, you can actually look at the playlist on the KEXP website, and it's quite a variety of samples. So to me, that's also very interesting radio, where you're playing all these different genres of music when you're playing the samples. So soundtrack music and, you know, hip hop and funk, you know, is just all over the place. And so it would be cool to tune in and hear all 12 hours of that. I bet it's amazing.
So we'll put a link to the playlist, and I don't know how long the archive will be available, but we'll put a link to that as well at our show notes. So radiosurvivor.com/podcast. And of course, that's where you can always find the show. You can also find it on iTunes if you use iTunes to listen or download or subscribe to the show. And if you do subscribe there, we'd love to ask you to drop us a rating, click on some stars. And if you have an extra second or two, leave us a review. That helps out a lot. It helps people find the show. It brings it to the attention of people working at iTunes Podcasts. And also when it is more likely for someone to want to subscribe when they see a show not only is there, but that somebody else would recommend it. So we would really appreciate if you do that. If you have any comments or anything you think we should cover, send us an email. podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And one other pitch I wanted to make is for our Patreon campaign. That is our fundraising campaign. And it's a lot like, you know, funding radio, community radio or public radio. We're asking for people to give us a little bit of money every single month to help fund everything we do at Radio Survivor, from our website, which has been online since 2009, to this podcast, which we're now in episode 9 of. nearly 2 months now. It's kind of amazing. And what you do is you go to patreon.com/radiosurvivor and you pick a level, and you can start out as $1 a month, so $12 a year. But if you can afford more, that's great. And we're trying to share some extra bonus content with folks who become Patreon subscribers. I've got a couple of extra pieces from the podcast I'm ready to put up there. I thought I'd have it done today, but I don't, including a piece from our interview with Dr. Christopher Terry, telling us a little bit about his time in commercial radio. It's a pretty interesting anecdote.
A great story that was cut for time and because it was sort of completely from left field. It was not on topic, but boy, was it fun to hear about.
Yeah, you'll learn how he got on Rush Limbaugh's radar. And we also have some great stuff from last week's show that didn't quite make it on, where the folks from Bainbridge Community Broadcasting were sharing some of their community outreach tips and some of the things that they were doing to help build audience and to build that outreach. And it's interesting because they've kind of built it into what they do because they are, you know, they're a podcasting broadcaster rather than a strict radio broadcaster. They've sort of made community outreach part of what they do with the podcasts. And it's really interesting to hear about. And we didn't quite have time. We're trying to keep the show to about an hour. And so we're sharing that with our Patreon subscribers. So that's at patreon.com/radiosurvivor. I hope you'll consider helping us out because this is we have no commercials. We've gotten rid of the banner ads on our website. We're really trying to do this with community support in the spirit of community radio. Well, I think it's time to hear about your college radio travels, Jennifer.
Yes, my very recent travels. So yesterday I visited the college radio station at University of Oregon in Eugene. And the call letters are KWVA. And my husband, he's always curious about what the call letters stand for. And sometimes I forget to ask that. So he asked, and WVA stands for Willamette Valley Alternative. So it's kind of cool. Back when some stations got their call letters, the call letters actually stand for something relevant. So Charlotte Nisser, the general manager, she met up with us at the station on a Saturday morning during the summer. And the building, interestingly, is under construction, so I met at the loading dock. Meet me at the loading dock. and she let us in. The building was closed pretty much to everybody, but the radio station is staffed 24/7 with people on the air 24/7. So we came in and into the nice, cool air-conditioned studio and learned more about what they were up to. And it was a little bit of a different day because they were doing a live remote.
We are doing a live broadcast or a live remote from the Whitaker Block Party. The Whitaker is a neighborhood in Eugene that has a variety of small businesses and, of course, lots of housing. And so they shut down a few blocks and have vendors and music. I think they have three stages this year. I can't tell you who the artist is at the moment, but we've been there live broadcasting since it started at 11:30. We'll be there till 10 o'clock tonight. So it's a big, exciting event.
I love that sort of thing. I love it when a radio station can support a neighborhood, like, you know, something on a small stage that's just for a few hundred people, and then kind of boost that out.
Yeah, and I think it's a pretty big block party, actually, that's been going on for, I don't know, nearly a decade. And it sounds like they've been there doing these live broadcasts most years. So that was cool. I was at the station at maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they started broadcasting around 11:30, and they were continuing until 10 at night. So Charlotte was actually going back and forth between the festival and the station. And then she had people doing monitoring the board at the station, and they have an 8-second delay. So if, you know, they told bands ahead of time, you know, please don't, you know, this is being broadcast over the radio, so don't swear. But if something, you know, out of the ordinary came through, they could push this dump button. So that was interesting that was going on. We talked a bit about the fact that the station is going to have to move pretty soon because, as I mentioned, the building is under construction and it's quite the undertaking. So they're going to be moving actually to a much larger space, which is going to be great. They're going to have three times the size. And they're moving to the basement, where college radio stations are often in the basement. And So now it's kind of this funky station. They've been around since 1993. The walls are covered with posters and graffiti and stickers and all this great stuff that makes a college radio station feel like home. So it's going to be a little bit different moving into a pristine new space. So there might be some challenges with that in how do we take a bit of the old with us and deal with the brand sparkling new. So I was talking to her about, you know, are you going to be able to take your sticker-covered cabinets? You know, they may have to negotiate things like that. And the station is pretty large. It's a large, active station. So what do you think makes KWVA unique or different from other college radio stations?
KWVA is different from other college stations in that it is a large station. There's about 150 volunteers who are involved, and we broadcast 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So that's unique. Mostly students are involved. There are some community members involved. I think that also sets us apart from other college stations. And I think our content is probably similar because we play an eclectic mix of things. All of our DJs get to pick and choose what they want to play. So there's a lot of variety in there. We have everything from hip-hop to 80s to classical, rock of various sorts, of course. We have noise programs. It really varies based on the DJ's interest. There's no set or prescribed program or formatting.
So that's great because I bet a lot of our listeners are probably aware that the technology exists now for radio stations, college radio stations and community radio stations, let alone other bigger stations, to go totally automated, to sort of let iTunes or programs like iTunes go all night long. So that must be a real challenge to keep a station on the air 24 hours.
Yeah, and I mean, they have 150 people, so that helps with that challenge. She did say that over the summer, it's a fewer number of people who are at the station. So they make some adjustments to the schedule. So they have shows are a little bit longer than they are during the school year, so that, and I remember that from my days in college radio in the summer, we did much longer programs since we had fewer DJs around. But yeah, it seems like they have a lot of dedicated people, so they're able to fill up that airtime. And if they aren't, they do have the ability to do automation, but not in the sense of it completely controlling you know, some stations have kind of this DJ assist system where
right.
it's still kind of automated even when there's a DJ there. And that's not the sense I get there. You know, so DJs are playing things from all the current music they add is on CD. So they're playing CDs from the library. They also have turntables they can use. The LPs that they have at the station are in deep storage right now, kind of in preparation for this move. So people don't have access to a lot of vinyl unless they bring it in. I asked about cassette tapes, which I always like to ask about cassette tapes. And they don't have a cassette deck, but they do have the ability to plug in your own inputs. So there are people who bring in their own cassette players to play cassettes, like in particular a noise show she mentioned plays stuff
of course.
On cassette,
yeah.
As they should. And they are digitizing some of their library right now, too. So she showed me these kind of spindles that you can stack a bunch of CDs on so you can digitize a whole bunch of music at the same time.
Huh. So it's an automated process.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know.
That's exciting.
They're always fun toys that you run across. And then another, I was going to share another interesting anecdote. I was asking her if, are there things that are completely different about your station or shows that you think aren't happening at many other places? Do you have any shows that you think are unique to your station?
One of our talk programs particularly comes to mind. It's called Anarchy Hour, and it is hosted by John Zerzan, who is an internationally known anarchist author. We were in the news, international news, for his program about a year and a half ago when it was found out that Adam Lanza had called into his program. So, of course, that was discovered after the court had released documents and some reporter had investigated and found a connection between the two. And so, of course, there were all kinds of requests for use permission to use the audio of Adam speaking with John on the air. That was quite the experience. It's a really diverse program, of course, all about anarchy. He talks a lot about what's going on in the news and speaking and writing and just reflections that he has. And he gets callers frequently who ask about what's going on in the world of anarchy. Eugene has a very large anarchist community, so it makes sense that that program is here, that he is here as well.
So the idea of the Sandy Hook shooter, Adam Lanza, calling in a couple of years ago, I guess, to this talk show across the country in Eugene, Oregon, I imagine that might have been difficult for a college station to handle the amount of heat that would be coming down on them for such a strange little moment in that college's broadcast history.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And Charlotte mentioned that, you know, when everything was in the news, she definitely reached out to some college radio organizations to give people a heads up, like, hey, just want to let you know that he did call into the show that was on our station. So she was kind of out ahead of it because they were already starting to get calls. So rather than retreating from it, she was sort of upfront about what they were dealing with. And you know, she's a longtime general manager there. She's, you know, one of these adult general managers. There are a lot of different ways that college radio stations are organized. And she was the student general manager when she was a student there. But now she's a professional who is in charge of the station. So I think she's got a great deal of maturity to handle this sort of situation. I think if you didn't have a strong leader, probably something like this would be even more terrifying.
And it's great that there are these organizations. She probably talked with College Broadcasters Incorporated and Intercollegiate Broadcast System, which are there to provide that level of support, you know, because odds are even something like this has happened before, even if it may have been decades prior. And you can call upon the wisdom, the accrued wisdom in these organizations. They often have legal counsel. And I'm sure she probably availed herself of some counsel there at University of Oregon as well. So I'm sure they would want to know about that. Having been a college radio advisor myself, I know that, you know, that's an important role is to have somebody, whether it's a general manager or an advisor who can, you know, help be a liaison to make sure that people are aware and that you can avail yourself of the help that's available, but also importantly, not allow that to compromise the really important freedom of speech and freedom of artistic expression that does happen. And that could, there could be a significant, especially, you know, I think people see the word anarchist and they worry, and there could be a significant amount of kind of reflexive blowback that would be way over the top compared to what actually happened. And it sounds like the station was able to handle that pretty well and preserve this very important platform that it provides.
Yeah, and I really, you know, I really respect people who are working in journalism and media on college campuses and high school campuses, because there is, you do have to uphold freedom of speech, and sometimes it's very difficult and you have a lot of pressure not to. Yeah, so they have a lot of interesting talk shows, music shows, a lot of sports programming. It's a really quite the variety on the schedule they had. They also have a prison-oriented show that started as somebody's graduate school project where they were reading material written by prisoners. So definitely one of the more diverse stations I've been to as far as having a variety of talk and music programming. And then, as I mentioned, I had my family with me on this tour. And so I wanted to play a little bit of a budding, budding radio personality, my daughter. This is Miss B.
So what do you love about college radio?
I love the constant variety of content and people who come through the door and the different people that I get to work with every day.
So do you work with college students?
I do work with college students, and I work with members of the community as well, because KWVA has volunteers who are students as well as community members.
So it's actually kind of hard to wrest the mic away from the 9-year-old asking her own follow-up questions. So yeah, it was a great visit, and it actually makes me encouraged about doing more radio station visits on my family vacation now that I know that I have an assistant producer along with me.
And it's great. What it sounds like, KWVA is really knit itself into the Eugene community. So in addition to being knit into the University of Oregon community, they're there at the Street Fest during the summer. You know, Eugene is known for being a hot a center for anarchist organizing, and not necessarily violent anarchist organizing, but as a real political kind of movement organizing. And they have shows dedicated to that, as well as shows, it sounds like, dedicated to a lot of different musics and genres that seem to go beyond what your typical sort of stereotypical college music student, college students' taste in music would be. And that's always a great thing to hear when students are able to kind of look, you know, use radio as this opportunity to look around them and to really, you know, be at home in the communities. Because I think you hear in college towns often what's called the town and gown divide, that, you know, there are some communities that feel like, well, these students come here, they come to college, but they're sort of just like extended tourists, and they don't ever really get to know the town or get to know the city and get involved. And this college radio station there at the University of Oregon sounds like a great means by which students get to know other community members, as well as be out there literally on the streets broadcasting.
Yeah, it was really cool. And it's interesting, you know, when, as we're talking about it now, it all makes sort of a perfect story. But, you know, when you're visiting a station, you're trying to take it all in, and there's so much to look at. But yeah, it is cool to see how tied they are to the community.
Well, that's great. So that's KWVA. They're online, I hope.
They are. And they're also 88.1 FM. I should not neglect to mention how
you're driving through.
How you can listen to them terrestrially. Yeah. And they're online. Yeah. So I would encourage people to take a look.
Great. We'll have that in the show notes at radiosurvivor.com/podcast.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Sure.
Coming up next in the program, we're going to have a tribute to Negative Land's Don Joyce, a real radio innovator and pioneer. Looking forward to that.
Man, we all missed a whole lot, didn't we?
Well,
Joyce,
I don't.
That sounds like Mark Hostler playing.
Ha 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 ha
On July 22nd of this year, we were all saddened to learn about the passing of Don Joyce, who died of heart failure at the age of 71 at his home in Oakland, California. He was a great broadcaster, somebody who is almost impossible, I think, to sum up in any one sentence. And he worked with the band Negative Land. He became a member of Negative Land, but he'd been a broadcaster, it seems like, almost his entire adult life, but before he met the guys in Negative Land, along with them on his show called Over the Edge, which aired on KPFA-FM in Berkeley, California. And Jennifer, you're friends with Peter Konheim, who's also a member of Negative Land, and Peter was really generous enough to share his remembrance that he wrote about Don Joyce on our website. And maybe you can put in context a little bit why we're all feel the loss of Don Joyce and why we think Negative Land is kind of so important to broadcasting.
Yeah, when I read Peter's piece, it really struck me how important Don Joyce was for radio. He had this Over the Edge show on KPFA since 1981. And to me, anybody who has had a show for 34 years, like, that's important in and of itself. And it was also this crazy collaborative creative space for sound collage and, you know, I guess improv comedy and, you know, a place for all these weirdos. And Peter also pointed out that radio was the perfect medium for Don Joyce, who maybe wasn't as comfortable with people one-on-one, but with radio, he was able to really blossom as an artist. So for me, it was really compelling reading his tribute. It made me realize the ways in which radio was so important to Negative Land, the project. And Negative Land is a beloved project to so many people in experimental music as well as radio because of all of the interesting things they've done over the years with sampling and, you know, pulling things from movies and, you know, all sorts of places in creative ways. And I know that that's been inspiring for a lot of DJs, particularly college radio DJs, late night DJs who might have these free form shows where they're just pulling from who knows where. And I think people were also sending in samples to Don Joyce, you know, over the years. So he has had kind of these tentacles reaching out to all these different collaborators, some of which have also been part of KFJC, where I DJ. So I think he's been a hugely influential person, and it's a big loss for radio and for music.
And yeah, I mean, I think very influential in that methodology of sonic collage, and which of course done live on the radio, yeah, on Over the Edge, and which they would also do in studio for their own record releases. Perhaps the most famous of which is their U2 EP, which featured their own versions of I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, which had studio outtakes of Casey Kasem losing his cool and trying to describe U2 and a little dog named Snuggles, which then got them sued by U2.
By U2's
Island
label.
Records, yeah. Yeah. Not because of the use of the samples, but because the album had a big U2 on front, and they alleged that someone might mistake it for an actual U2 record rather than a Negative Land record. And an interesting part as well, I think, is that, you know, not only did he go out and sort of gather samples that people would send in, but he would find things on like CB radio. And there was always an open line and Over the Edge and callers. And if you were a caller, you might hear your voice turn up on a later Negative Land release if it was a particularly crazy or interesting interaction. And everything just becomes this fodder. And I think the word, you know, it's sort of tired now, but you'd call it, it's postmodern. And at a time, you know, pioneered at a time when that was a very cutting edge approach, you know, is before there was digital sampling, before everyone could cut and paste audio on their computers. They were doing it with tape, you know, with razor blades and putting things together with carts, which you use, you know, right, in radio stations for playing loops, for playing commercials and things like this, and finding and making their own methods for creating the kind of deep deeply knit, tightly knit audio collage that almost no one else was doing, because in a lot of ways you had to make the means in order to do it. And a radio studio was their instrument as much as the instruments that they brought in. And it hugely influential to me when I first heard, I think I probably just first heard the U2 EP when I was in college radio. And, you know, I'd heard of Negative Land, but it, you know, this would have been, you know, 1990, 1991 or so. And so harder to find this stuff. And I finally hear this and I go, what in the world is this? This is fantastic. And then I just dived head in. Yeah, there was no turning back to getting into the Negative Land oeuvre at that point.
What's cool, too, I had my radio show at KFJC this week, so I played some Negative Land, and we actually have CDs at the station that are of Over the Edge radio shows. So even if you haven't been a regular listener, you can even pick up a CD and kind of get a sense of what that crazy show is like.
Right.
And then you were mentioning the carts. If people look at the piece that we published on Radio Survivor, we have a great picture that Dirk Richardson took of Don Joyce in the studio with a bunch of carts in front of him.
Yeah, he was really – so I'm a huge fan of the show Over the Edge, and I worked at KPFA. Sometimes late at night I'd be finishing something for one of my gigs, and I would stumble into what Don Joyce was working on live. And it was always the amount of gear that he would bring into the studio to supplement the gear that he would be using in the studio was always amazing. And those carts are iconographic. They'll always be identified with Don Joyce and his work on this weird show that was so incredible. So yeah, it was a radio show that aired on KPFA every Thursday evening from midnight till 3 a.m., but sometimes from midnight to 5 a.m. That seemed kind of random. But I guess it made sense. He would fill the time as necessary. And I guess what I want listeners to know is, like, it was so weird. And, I mean, I guess we could play an example of how weird it was. But, here, listen.
First and fast with the voice of the Bay, KY, more music time.
This weird one, is an episode called How Radio Was Done, Part 17, from Over the Edge on September 29th, 2006. And How Radio Was Done was this ongoing series, this never-ending series of where the collage work that Don Joyce would do was primarily focused on what radio sounded like year by year. And so part 17 from 2006 was creeping into the mid-60s. And this is what it sounded like. A little bit of an example of the collage work that they would do on the air.
Science for Survival. Telling the story of nuclear radiation and how we can protect ourselves from the hazards of radioactive fallout. You owe it to yourself to see it. Science for Survival. Next trip you take to the fair.
What should I write? What can I say? How can I tell?
One of the things that I wanted to make sure that people knew is that despite the fact that Over the Edge was on late at night, Thursday nights was a big deal at KPFA. The two preceding DJs, the 4 hours leading into Don Joyce's program, were probably two of KPFA's like strongest professional music DJs. So the lead-in to, yeah, one of them was Dirk Richardson, who took this picture that we see on the Radio Survivor tribute to Don Joyce. The lead-in to the show was serious, and then the show itself was so very strange. How do we describe how strange it was?
What I love about it is that he really played with what is radio. So right. You have to sort of imagine you're listening to community radio KPFA, and now you hear what sounds like commercial music radio from 1972 or 1965. And so while we sort of play this without context, you go, well, that sounds like this. But if you're listening to the radio in, when was this recorded, 2000?
That was 2006.
2006, this is a complete anachronism. Right. And they've assembled it lovingly to sound like an AM pop radio station in 1965, but it's completely fabricated. And I think that's sort of their genius, is to take that, play with the listeners' expectations, and turned a little bit. It's a bit of a detournement, if you will. And you sort of, what the heck is it I'm listening to? And I think the big, one of the things they elicit from especially the casual listener who might be hitting seek as they drive around in their car going, what is this? And of course, it doesn't end up being what it sounds like it's going to be. That setup, I think, is just where things start. It quickly sort of devolves or gets weirder as it goes along.
Yeah, he really did a lot of layering.
I thought it was interesting in Peter's tribute, which we have on Radio Survivor. He talks about how Don Joyce was transformed and he had a regular radio show. It would be interesting to hear what his radio show was like before he was introduced to Negative Land, but apparently he had a regular radio show and then he was introduced to, you know, these tricksters and noise musicians, and it completely changed the way he thought of radio. So that was a transformative experience for him, and it changed the way he did his show.
Right. Well, I actually have a clip of that, of Don Joyce talking about that from a YouTube documentary that was posted, that I pulled the sound from. So we'll hear a little of it. It's Negative Land's Mark Hostler and Don Joyce on a documentary series that was generously posted to YouTube from the year 2000. It was called Circuit.
Once we went up to the radio station, I don't know why we were like this, but just immediately we just started turning records on and off and backwards and playing tape loops and adding in all kinds of crazy things, which at that time you had never done.
No, I had never done it. No, and I had never thought of it. And they came up the first time probably ever in a radio station and just did
it. We just immediately started wrecking it.
Naivete, they just said, oh, look at all this equipment. And they filled it all up and we started turning it on and off. And
there were three turntables, four reel-to-reels, two cassette decks. There was like three cart machines. We brought in auxiliary mixers, our synthesizers, and rhythm machines. And then you could put two phone callers on the air, which we were real excited about because they could just do whatever they wanted.
So again, that's a clip from the documentary series Circuit, which we'll have a link to. So yeah, I think what we'll do next is we'll just hear a little bit from Don's final broadcast, which was actually just 1 week before the tribute broadcast when he passed.
Thanks for stopping.
Hello.
Don't say hello. Good morning.
He just
left. Was that the wrong number?
I'll stop saying that because every time they say something dumb and hang up.
Before I start checking the cables.
Yeah,
there
I am. Thanks
for that, Tony. Thank you.
Breaking stuff again.
What happened?
We're jumping around here. It doesn't matter.
It's all a mess.
Four. Just one.
Bring it on, baby.
Nobody talks to you. You don't even know if you're on the friggin' radio.
You're not on the friggin' radio. The old oil filter not coming off, and they tried and they dented it and wouldn't come off, so they just said, screw it.
What I love about that, it was almost this dense summarization of Negative Land in so many ways. And you hear this part where he says, don't say hello. And amongst Negative Land devotees and listeners who would like to call in, that's the rule. Because they would just answer the phone and patch you into the board. So don't say hello was, once you hear the phone quit ringing, meant you're on the air. So don't say hello and ruin it. But they would get people who call in, and that becomes part of the sort of running joke. And as you listen to that, you don't know whether you're hearing calls or audio of themselves, never mind the listeners, that's live,
right,
or could be from 15 years ago that's been patched into the mix there.
It's so spooky. I mean, you could drive yourself crazy trying to figure out all the different layers in there. You know, I could recognize a little bit of close to the edit, you know, but yeah, we don't know if it's old samples, new calls, people right in the studio, who is that putting on the fake voice, which one of them.
Right. Well, that's my experience with the show. One of the first times was I was up in the news studio at KPFA working, and some weirdo who I did not recognize, who didn't scare me, but was overdressed for the occasion. Let's put it that way. He was using the news studio, which I guess Don had patched in to the on-air studio downstairs. And this weirdo, who I forget his name, was just monologuing in the news studio for hours, probably not monitoring what was going on the air, and just doing a wonderful job of talking. So stuff like that was... Well, that was actually my first experience of how the show was produced live. Apropos to this point, also was how amazing it was when the How Radio Was Done series would go on and on year by year. And at some point, it reached the year when Negative Land started broadcasting on the radio, and that's when it really twisted into a very ridiculous spiral.
Folded in on itself.
And what's amazing, we have to mention, and I learned about this from the tribute that was written up, is that all of these shows are going to be available in high-quality archives, because right now we're listening to what KPFA makes available, which is a pretty, which is a generous MP3, but not very nice to listen to. But all 5,000-plus hours of Don Joyce's radio work on Over the Edge are going to be archived later this year, later next year, on the Internet Archive, which is really incredible, because the resource, the fact that what he was doing in his work was bringing back the history of what had been and of what had come before it, and not only recontextualizing and repurposing it, but just also like bringing it back, because these were lost, these are dead sounds. Like, what did radio sound like in the 80s? There's no way to know except
Very few air checks, right? These are not, you know, radio stations don't generally archive everything they do. Although increasingly, because of internet streams, that's happening more often by accident,
right,
not necessarily on purpose. But yes, to think of 5,000 hours of this show, which I know the guys at Negative One, they recorded it themselves, which of course sometimes they would turn into the CD releases,
right,
or they would, you used to be able to buy cassettes of it from them online, not online, but by mail order. And to have that all archived and I mean, digitized, first of all, because I'm sure most of this was on cassette or some kind of reel-to-reel, and made available for posterity, because archive.org works very hard to keep things not just digitized, but to keep to secure the life of these materials that they put on, that they put online and keep online. It's really pretty fantastic to think that will be available.
Yeah, it looks like it's by the end of the year, actually, so not too far off that we'll be able to access all of that.
Quite fittingly, there have been radio tributes to Don Joyce, and I'm sure we know there will be more, at least one more. Community radio station KBOO in Portland, Oregon, did their own two-hour tribute to Don Joyce, in very much Negative Land style, where they had callers prearranged as well as an open phone line for people to share their memories or just share their own surrealism. And KBOO is featuring that on their website, and we'll have a link to that at radiosurvivor.com/podcast. And KFJC, the station where you work, is planning something, isn't that right?
Yeah, it's still in the works, but probably in the next couple weeks, there will be a Negative Land special with some members of Negative Land, as well as some collage artists and various people doing antics over the air. And it may even be a 24-hour special. So,
wow.
It's not confirmed yet, so you're hearing it here first.
So we'll definitely alert you to it at radiosurvivor.com. And if we have enough lead time, we'll let you know about it on the podcast as well. And then at KPFA, you have a clip here, right, of the great tribute that aired on Over the Edge.
Right. So it's important to note that Don Joyce's show Over the Edge is not going off the air. His friends are going to hold that space until they can figure out how to pass the torch.
So yeah, we're going to hear an episode of Over the Edge that the remaining members of Negative Land did the day after Don Joyce died, and it's an interesting interpretation of the obituary that has a lot of effects and additional commentary added to it that is pretty beautiful.
It was Don who took the idea of reshaping previously recorded words in a pre-sampling age and ran with it to such an extent and a depth that was never before heard and never equaled. Recontextualization became his weapon, with the quarter-inch tape machine and the razor blade his ammunition, and the radio cart player, which, by the way, is an entirely forgotten piece of broadcast history that uses endless loop tape cartridges, and he used it until his death. That was his delivery system. Tonight, we don't have any of the cart machines sitting here because, unfortunately, the hospital threw away this giant bag of personal items that he had with him, which included all of his cart machines, and they put them in hazardous waste. It was an unfortunate loss, but, well, he was the only person who knew how to actually perform on a cart tape machine anyway.
Well, when he and Negative Land discovered their mutual love for found sound, an intensely collaborative, creative partnership was indeed cemented, and it continued nonstop for the ensuing decades. With Don endlessly scanning the airwaves of radio and TV along with his massive LP collection. Those are popular again, you know. For new material day by day, week by week. You see, he was ahead of the curve, you know. He had his records and he kept them there and he was ready to use them. And he used them for 35 years. Now they're popular again. You see, he was ahead of the curve.
If you read the obituary that Peter Conheim wrote and is on the Negative Land website on Us One Radio Survivor, you'll notice similarities. So in that broadcast on Over the Edge, they are reading the piece and then adding to it, adding additional bits and pieces of commentary. And it really makes for a Negative Land style interpretation of an obituary. And even in the obituary, you can see how they're trying to communicate the joy of Don Joyce, and the obituary lists off all of the characters that died on the same day as Don Joyce. Yeah. So pretty incredible piece of work. And I can't imagine what it was like for them to come in and do the show the day after he died.
Right. And I guess one more thing we should mention about Don Joyce and his work, that he was a prolific essayist, right? And monologuist. I don't know if prolific is the right word, but, you know, sometimes he'd just be mixing all of this weirdness together, and then a well-written rant would play for quite some time on the follow-up album to the controversy over their U2 fair use issue. They released an album called The Fair Use Something Something, the letter U and the numeral 2, and it featured a 25-minute monologue, a rant slash, but a very well thought out, clear-headed rant.
An audio essay, if you will.
Yeah, by Don Joyce. And I really, during, later on in the broadcast that Negative Land put together following his passing, they played what I assume was not never before heard live performance of one of those essays.
And musicians, I'm suggesting we're now past the point of discovering anything good in music that has not already been tried. After so many centuries of manipulating and remanipulating the same scales up and down of a finite number of notes, we have actually reached the end of all even slightly useful combinations. Oh, there's plenty of note combinations left that don't sound good. That's why they're left. But all the great, good, sort of good, and hesitantly acceptable note combinations have been used up long ago. Why do you think music is so boring now? Just try to write any melody whatsoever that does not sound like a melody that already exists. That's been difficult for some time, and now it's finally impossible. Why do you think punk rock emerged, drenched in desperation? Do you think there was some kind of socio-musical politics involved? No, vote again. All that angry angst was actually about evading this melody problem. If only for under 1 minute in musical history. By eliminating melody altogether. But so what? Like every other kind of so-called new music, that had been done before too. It's kind of sad, really, to see how every avant branch of music just continues on and on, grasping at blind hope, delusional beyond repair, in complete denial of the now simply obvious fact that it's all been done before. And nothing categorically new will ever be possible in music again. Get used to it. The fact is,
of course, that was from a broadcast that Negative Land, members of Negative Land, did following the passing of their friend Don Joyce on KPFA on his show Over the Edge. And we'll have a link to that MP3 for you if you want to listen to the whole 3 hours. I recommend it.
And that'll all be there at radiosurvivor.com/podcast. And now, Lasar's Letter on Radio.
This is Matthew Lasar with Lasar's Letter on Radio for the Radio Survivor podcast. Today I'm going to read some excerpts from poems about radio, or that mention radio. Let's start with Tom Clark's 1992 poem titled Radio. Don't hurt the radio, for against all solid testimony, machines have feelings too. Brush past it lightly, with a fine regard for allowing its molecules to remain 100% intact. Machines can think like Wittgenstein, and the radio's a machine thinking softly to itself of the midnight flower as her tawny parts unfold. That was an excerpt from Radio by Tom Clark. Now here's a portion of Honey by Ariel Greenberg. I dream I am guided by an elderly couple in a dim farmhouse to their morning radio and blackberry tea, and then given the combs, which I snap into my dry mouth, where they fill and fill. Never upon awakening have I been so empty and wanted more a cracker. Never so suffused with the weekly, with time, as another god passing through the many perfect crypts and ambers I house beneath my skin. A little section from the poem Honey by Ariel Greenberg. And now a bit from A Fox's Tale is Called a Brush by Emily Pettit. I break up all the leaves into bits. I am hard at summer. Let the music loud. I can have a color in my mind and I cannot make it. How do you make a mirror? I want you to understand. Do you understand me? I understand. They understand. You understand. I hope your summer is being a good summer. Grasses and radios. Get archaic. A hunter looking for a streaming blue. You are in the weather. You, idea. A not new idea. A room. I got home and my door was blue. It was a fox and a picture of you. A Fox's Tale is Called a Brush by Emily Pettit. And finally, Radio Poem by Bertolt Brecht. You little box, held to me escaping, so that your valves should not break, carried from house, to ship from sail to train, so that my enemies might go on talking to me. Near my bed to my pain, the last thing at night, the first thing in the morning, of their victories and of my cares. Promise me not to go silent all of a sudden. Radio Poem by Bertolt Brecht. You've just heard excerpts of four poems about radio by Tom Clark, Ariel Greenberg, Emily Pettit, and Bertolt Brecht. This is Matthew Lasar for the Radio Survivor podcast. Thank you for listening to these words.
Thank you, Matthew.
And thank you, Jennifer, for joining us here in the podcast studio for this episode.
It's been really exciting to be here in person. I wish I could be here every week.
Yeah, come back soon.
I'll try.
Or we should come down to you.
That would be great. Yeah, and we could have Matthew live in the Lazar's Letter live in the studio.
That's right. We have sort of two home offices in San Francisco, California, and Portland, Oregon. We should be able to take the show on the road. That would be a lot of fun. And where else should we go? We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And, you know, if you have any comments about the show, you can certainly write them. We'd love to be able to share them on air, whether it's a critique or a compliment or a suggestion, or just you want to share your point of view. Even better, we'd love to hear you do it. Record it. Record it on your phone, record it on your computer, and send us the MP3 or a link to the MP3 or whatever file you have, and we'd love to be able to share it with the Radio Survivor listeners. We'd like to not have to be interpreters of your words, but let you speak for yourself here and reach out to this community of people who care passionately about great radio.
What's that email, Paul?
It is podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And you find the show at radiosurvivor.com/podcast. We're also on iTunes. We're also on Stitcher. The show should be easy to find. You've already found it if you're listening. But we always keep show notes. there at radiosurvivor.com/podcast so that you can follow up on many of the things we've mentioned and explore further. And especially, you will probably want to explore further the great works of Negative Land and Don Joyce, especially if maybe this is the first time you're really being exposed to it. We hope you will we will start you on that journey. And if you can help support the program, do so at patreon.com/radiosurvivor. Anything you can contribute will help keep this endeavor of love and passion keep going. That's patreon.com/radiosurvivor. Well, thank you, Eric, and thank you, Jennifer.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.